Hi, I'm Tony Rossi for the Christophers, and today I'll be talking with a woman whose volunteer efforts in a Charlotte, North Carolina soup kitchen eventually led her to tackle the problem of building housing for the homeless. Kathy Izzard will join me to discuss her book, The 100-Story Home, A Journey of Homelessness, Hope, and Healing. Stay with us. Christopher Close-Up starts right now. Hello and welcome to Christopher Close-Up. I'm Tony Rossi, and my guest today is Kathy Izzard. Kathy is a wife and mom who's made it her mission in life to provide housing for the homeless. But it was a long and winding road to get to that point, and even realizing that this cause meant so much to her. In addition to dealing with her mom's mental illness when she was growing up, Kathy also never felt the deep faith in God that her parents modeled for her. In fact, she didn't think God was listening to her at all. But that changed over time when she gained a new perspective on life. Kathy shares her story in the memoir, The 100-Story Home, A Journey of Homelessness, Hope, and Healing. So to tell us more, I'm pleased to welcome to Christopher Close-Up, Kathy Izzard. Kathy, thanks so much for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, now, you deal with a lot of aspects of your story in this book, The 100-Story Home, but I want to start with the one that you actually start the book with, and that's your mom's mental illness, because this is still a big issue in society today. It is not talked about probably nearly as much. There's probably more going on than people realize of people struggling with mental illness. So tell us a little bit about what she went through and how the illness manifested itself.
I think that what you said about people not talking about it is very correct. The book opens in 1963. I was 6 years old, and my mom, like many people that mental illness strikes, very brilliant, really doing amazing things in her life and a wonderful mother. But mental illness does creep in and affect people when they least expect it. And so it's kind of blindsiding not only to the person who experiences it, but also to the family as well. And that's certainly what happened to us. And I guess she would probably be in her early 30s. And she'd had, some bouts here and there that she thought was just small bouts of anxiety or depression. Mm-hmm. But then we realized probably in her 30s that she actually was bipolar. And some of those smaller episodes that she'd been able to work her way through or, take some sort of rest and then recover, that was not the case anymore. So we, from the time I was 6 years old, we started a lifelong process of trying to diagnose her, trying to get the right medicine management, and trying to understand how this was going to affect all of our lives. And I think that's a very similar story to many families, many patients, where it is so blindsiding, and mm-hmm. it's very difficult to get the right mix so that you can live, a well life after you have the right medical management and the right medicines as well to manage the brain chemistry, which is a big part of mental illness.
Sure. Well, what about your reaction as you were growing up? Because, as a kid, we all just kind of want to fit in. We want our parents to be completely normal, whatever that means. And, your mom, you said, had these episodes and was going through it. So how did you react to this whole thing?
I think our whole family just had to get through it and pretend it wasn't happening mm-hmm. and not talk about it. Yeah. And I talk in the book about how I had a friend whose father had cancer and how, her family was inundated with help. And, as we do in the South, this was Texas, but now I live in Charlotte, North Carolina. And when someone's sick, you bring casseroles, you bring fruit, food.
Yeah.
And I say in the book that chapter is called No Casseroles for Crazy because,
yeah.
Mental illness is a very different problem. The families don't talk about it, can't talk about it, feel somehow guilty or ashamed that this has happened. And so then people can't help or don't know how to help.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish that was different in 2017. I don't know that it is. I think there still is this stigma to it. And I think families still, when this strikes them, have to somewhat hide and protect the person that it's happening to and therefore don't have the support. It's very lonely for the patient. I think it's very lonely for the families.
Yeah, yeah. I'm talking to Kathy Izzard. She's the author of the book, The 100-Story Home, A Journey of Homelessness, Hope, and Healing. One of the other things that jumped out at me about that part of the book is, you know, we generally tend to think of hope as a good thing. But, you know, you write at one point, expectation for my mother's returned wellness was the only true pain. So how do you handle it when hope, which is supposed to be good, can actually lead to pain?
Oh, that's very interesting. I know. I think that, you know, mental illness sometimes brings heartbreak over and over. Because a patient might get well and then go through a very long period of, you know, normalcy or dealing really well with illness, and then something will strike and it reoccurs. And so you lose that hope and you're started over again. So it's difficult to answer that. But I do think, particularly today, there is so much more hope for folks who do have mental illness, because there is such a, you know, a progression of medicines and understanding and places that are available. I did work in Charlotte on opening a residential mental health treatment center, and it's called Hope Way. Okay. And for that exact reason, we wanted there to be hope for patients and families and caregivers, that this was not a lost cause, that there is hope for this illness and all those who are suffering with mental health and looking for mental wellness.
Right. I'm Tony Rossi. You're listening to Christopher Close-Up. I'm talking to Kathy Izzard. She's the author of The 100-Story Home, A Journey of Homelessness, Hope, and Healing. One of the other aspects of the book is you write about your parents had this really deep faith life. I love the fact that when they were dating, your dad brought along his Bible and read 1 Corinthians 13 to your mom about faith, hope, and love, and the greatest of these is love, and that's what won her over. How did you see
them?
Can
you believe that? I know.
It's such a great part of the story. How did you see them rely on their faith during your youth, in good times and bad?
Well, I think my father certainly demonstrated that over and over, that the greatest of these was love. He was certainly tested so many times as they were trying to understand my mother's illness and get the right medicines and help for her. And he really never wavered in his faith. He never... He didn't waver in his love for her. I mean, for better, for worse, in sickness and in health, he certainly followed those vows. And then again, later in his life, he had cancer. Mm-hmm. And I write a little bit about that in the book. And my mother was able to provide the same for him. She was an amazing source of constant support and had steadfast faith that his cancer would be cured. And so when he needed her in a really dark time, she was able to turn around and give that same, you know, faith and love to him.
Yeah, and even just that part of the story, you know, talking about the dealing with mental illness, she was able to recover enough to be able to do that for him. So that alone is another hopeful element of this book.
Absolutely. Yeah, she really was. I kept thinking that, you know, during that would really just test her, you know, to the breaking point, but it never did. I think she just knew at some, you know, gut level that she needed to stay strong for him, and she certainly did, and then has been widowed probably 17, 18 years now.
Oh, wow.
And has done, you know, remarkably well, but misses them every day. They definitely had a very special love.
Yeah. Well, talking about the God factor, you're very honest in the book, and I love this about the book. I love the fact that you struggled with your relationship with God and even believing in God. Why did God seem, you know, considering your parents were so faithful, devout, why did God seem so either distant or maybe non-existent to you?
I think because I grew up from a long line of Presbyterian ministers and even missionaries. My grandparents were missionaries in China. Mm-hmm. My grandfather grew up in Shanghai because his parents were Christian missionaries. And so I guess I felt growing up that faith was something that was more forced and not found. Mm-hmm. And so I was constantly being taken to church and Sunday school and all the different parts. But I guess because... If I saw my parents praying, which I did to, you know, help my mom, and at times when she wasn't, I guess there was part of me that didn't understand how you could pray to a God who wasn't answering your prayers.
Yeah.
And I guess as I grew older and, you know, what I know now is, you know, sometimes you can pray and maybe you are getting what you need, but you just don't realize it at the time.
Yeah.
And so I certainly went away from religion. And then once I started having my own kids, could see that at least I wanted them to have an understanding of religion and be able to choose it for themselves. And so that kind of brought me back to church. I tell a story in the book. I was completely embarrassed. Here I come from this, you know, really religious and faithful family. And we were at the YMCA in Charlotte swimming, and we're walking past a portrait in the YMCA with my four little girls. I have two girls and then a set of twin girls. And my oldest at the time, who was about eight, we walk past the picture, and she looks up and she says, "Mommy, who's that man?" And it was a picture of Jesus. I was horrified. I thought, oh my gosh, all of my ancestors are rolling over in their graves. I have taken this non-religion thing too far. And it started going back to church, which that led me to, we started volunteering for the soup kitchen and working with the homeless. And I think that to me became my church. You know, service is definitely something that my family grew up with. And then that led me back to a faith that I didn't know I'd lost.
Sure. So. I'm talking to Kathy Izzard. We're talking about her book, The 100-Story Home, A Journey of Homelessness, Hope, and Healing. Well, let's talk about that that service. You got involved with the Urban Ministry Center in Charlotte, North Carolina. So tell us about the choice to get involved and what kind of ministry was offered at the center.
What took us to the Urban Ministry Center was there was an ad in the bulletin of our church that wanting volunteers to work on the soup kitchen team. And I thought this was great because I had four little tomboys, so putting them in dresses and tights, as you need to do in the South to go to church, it's a dress-up thing. It was exhausting. So I thought, oh, this is great. I can, on Sundays, I'll take them once a month to work in the soup kitchen, and they can wear their blue jeans and sneakers, and this will be great. Mm-hmm. So honestly, that's how we ended up there. But once I got there, I realized what a special place it was. It's an interfaith ministry. Different organizations of all different churches, Catholic, Muslim, Buddhist. There's, I think, over 120 different houses of faith that Wow. volunteer there each month, and Mm-hmm. over 4,000 volunteers. And it's a no questions asked type of place. If you know, if you're there, you need help, and they serve. And I think another beautiful thing about Urban Ministry Center is they don't call the people they serve or help clients. They mm-hmm. call them neighbors.
Okay.
Because they want everyone there to feel like they're your neighbor. You're helping that person just like you would help the neighbor on your street and do what you can. And they do everything from provide a meal 365 days a year, they're always open mm-hmm. For lunch, but they also provide continuing things, showers, laundry, place for homeless to get their mail. So it really was quite the education to show up and realize this was happening in our community, to realize we had as many homeless people as we did, and then be a part of, in a little way, of trying to help each Sunday.
Well, what did you learn about poverty and more so the people affected by it? Because sometimes people have these images, you use the word homeless, and we have these images, how did that kind of conform to what you met? Was poverty affecting more people in different ways than you realized?
Absolutely. I didn't, I had no idea how many homeless people there were in Charlotte. I think, like in many cities, it's a very hidden problem, unless maybe you go to the center city or you look under highway bridges and you really start looking. In Charlotte, folks were camping out. There were tent camps all around downtown. There's folks who sleep under the bridges. So until I went to the Urban Ministry Center, I guess I thought we didn't have a problem in Charlotte mm-hmm. just because I hadn't seen it. I guess it was invisible to me. But once we showed up there, obviously very present, very visible, there were hundreds of people. We were feeding 600 people for lunch on any given day, and we'd show up and make sandwiches and soup, and not necessarily what you think. There were, you know, there were men, women, there were children, there were, you know, all different ages, there were all different ethnicities. It was very surprising to me to see who all showed up, and also the differences. Some were the classic, you know, mentally ill, had been on the streets for years. And we also happened to have the fourth Sunday of the month, mm-hmm. mm-hmm. which meant people's food stamps ran out. So very surprising to me to learn that people would come to a soup kitchen when their food stamps or their benefits ran out and they had run out of money at the end of the month and just needed to eat. And yeah. so those were also some of the people that would show up and that we would serve. So sure. it was quite the education.
Yeah. I'm Tony Rossi. You're listening to Christopher Close Up. I'm talking to Kathy Izzard. She's the author of The 100-Story Home, A Journey of Homelessness, Hope, and Healing. You mentioned before that you didn't call them the people who came there clients. You called them neighbors. But I'm curious, how difficult was it for you to see these neighbors that you served at the center, not just as this generic homeless label, but as like real three-dimensional human beings?
Well, I think to answer that question, honestly, for a good 15 years, I really kept my distance. Mm-hmm. I had been serving down there almost a decade, and I would come in with my kids, and we would serve. We would stand behind the lunch counter, and we would make lunch, and we would serve it. But I didn't really know anyone's name. I didn't really get to know any of the people. And I think that's because of my experience with my mother. I knew how complicated people's issues were. Mm-hmm. I knew how difficult it would be if I got to know someone. So I think I protected myself very well in the beginning of just showing up, serving soup, going home, feeling like that was enough. And then I wrote in the book how that all changed in 2007, 10 years ago, because I met someone who changed my perspective of how I was looking at people and if I was really helping.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think the person you're talking about is, well, the people you're talking about are Ron Hall and Denver Moore. So tell us a little bit about them, because they really, especially Denver, changed the course of your life.
He absolutely did. They wrote a book called The Same Kind of Different as Me, and it's actually coming out in a movie. The movie version will be out in October.
Oh.
But the movie, the book that I read at the time was about their relationship. And Ron Hall was an art dealer in Texas, and Denver Moore was a man who'd been homeless almost 30 years. And Ron was married to a woman, Debbie, who volunteered at the soup kitchen and kind of forced Ron to come down and help out at the soup kitchen. That was not his inclination. It was hers. But as a result of that, he met Denver Moore. And Denver changed the way Ron saw homeless and the way he treated homeless. And the two of them actually became family. And Ron and Deborah ended up bringing Denver into their home, and he became a part of their family.
Mm-hmm.
And the book that they wrote talks about their unlikely friendship and how it changed. So I read this book, and honestly, it really just kind of shamed me, because I realized I'd been doing the same thing. I'd been serving these people but never getting to know anyone.
Yeah.
And so as a result of that, I, on a wild inclination one day, I sent Ron an email and asked if they ever spoke, and I invited them to Charlotte to speak at an event to benefit the Urban Ministry Center. But at the time, I had no authority to be doing this. There was no event. And it was a little bit crazy, to tell you the truth, Tony. But lucky for me, Ron answered, and they did end up coming. And I was in charge of a lunch that we held as a benefit for the Urban Ministry Center. And through that, I had a conversation with Denver where I was taking him down to the Urban Ministry Center. And I thought he was going to pat us on the back for all the great things we were doing, the showers, the laundry, the soup. And as I was taking them around on this tour, we had a wildly uncomfortable moment where he asked me, where are the beds?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, there are no beds. We're a soup kitchen. We're a day shelter. We're a ministry. And he said, you mean to tell me you do all this good in the day and you lock them out to the bed at night?
Mm.
And I said, well, yeah. And he said, does that make any sense to you? I had to say, nope.
Mm.
And he said, are you going to do something about it? And I'll have to tell you, in that moment, I looked over my shoulder. I was hoping the executive director was standing there. I was hoping he was talking to somebody besides me.
Mm-hmm.
But he wasn't. And it just changed me from that moment on, because and I couldn't sleep at night because I couldn't forget what he said. I knew he was right. I knew that we weren't doing enough. I didn't know what that meant on how to change it or what I could do, but I knew that I couldn't go down there and just serve soup anymore and pretend that people weren't locked out to the vat at night and pretend I didn't know what happened to them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I have to say, when I was reading that part of your story, I think I felt you conveyed the discomfort you felt, because I felt it too in my, you know, as I was reading it, I felt like what you were going through, how, because you were faced with this, you thought you were doing this great thing, and here you are challenged to do something more. And I'm talking to Kathy Izzard. We're talking about her book, The 100 Story Home. So what exactly did you do after that encounter? Because now you're taking on a whole new mission of creating shelters for the homeless. How did that mission start playing out?
Well, it started out when I admitted to my husband that I was feeling this call, this very crazy call to do something about it. And luckily, he didn't call me crazy. It also coincided at a time in my life. I was around, you know, mid-40s, and I was really looking for a career change. I'd been a graphic designer. That I had a business that I was able to work out of my home, and I had clients. I had these four small kids, but I knew that I wanted to be doing something else with my life. So I ended up 2 months after my conversation with Denver, I ended up closing my business and going to work for the Urban Ministry Center, and we launched a program called Homeless to Homes. Mm-hmm. And we did some research about the best practices in the country. Were we talking about beds at the time? I didn't even know. Were we talking about bunk beds? Were we talking about shelters? What if I was going to do something, what would we do? And the best, kind of the best practice in the country at the time, and still is housing first. And that is the idea that people don't necessarily need to earn the right to housing. I think the prevailing thought in the country a decade ago or more is that a homeless person needed to earn the right into a house. They needed to become sober. They needed to go through all of these steps. Mm-hmm. And then earn the right into a home. But the problem with that philosophy is, if it is 32 degrees and you are freezing under a bridge and all you can think about is your next meal, what are you going to do? Sobriety is a very high bar.
Yeah.
And getting a job is a very high bar. So it becomes almost impossible for someone to get out of their situation and earn their right into housing. And so Housing First philosophy started, said, well, what if we did the opposite? What if we just said, as a human being, there is a right to housing. There is a right to be sheltered and off the streets. And what if we just housed people and then worked on what they needed, whether that was sobriety or education or mental health treatment or physical wellness? And so that's the way our program started, was a Homeless to Homes pilot program, where we took 13 people who'd been chronically homeless for years in Charlotte, some as many as two decades, and we found them apartments and we moved them into housing directly off the streets, put them with a caseworker, and tried to work on the issues that had, you know, made them homeless for decades. Yeah. And what we found out is amazing things happen when you restore people's hope, when you restore their dignity, and you give them that shot.
Well, what is your goal now? I mean, obviously, you're keeping this program going, but do you want to expand this to other cities, this idea?
Well, we did not invent this idea. We actually went to other cities who were doing it. We looked at Seattle. We looked at New York. We looked at Salt Lake. There were cities who were already doing this. So what we did is we took the pilot program, the book, Not to Steal the Punchline, we ended up building a place that is named after Denver Moore, that is permanent supportive housing for chronically homeless. They're apartments that the Urban Ministry Center owns and can, you know, it houses over 120. We've now moved almost 450 people off the streets.
Wow.
And yes, there is, we are hoping to build another more place, another place just like it, and continue to expand the offerings here in Charlotte. And there is a goal here. There is a coalition brought together to be the first city in the United States to end chronic homelessness, to say that this doesn't exist in our city anymore. So,
yeah. Is there an economic benefit? Because everybody basically looks at the bottom line with these kinds of things. Have you seen any kind of economic benefit to doing things this way? Does it cost less in the long run?
It absolutely does. And when we were raising money to build more place, to build this apartment complex for the homeless, we found out that was our best story. I mean, there were people who obviously who just in their hearts believed that they wanted to give to something like this to get people off the streets. That there was at one point 37 people a year died on the streets of Charlotte, mm-hmm. Just as a result of homelessness. But the fact is, it costs more to leave people on the streets than it does to house them. When people are on the streets, they overuse jails, ER rooms, hospital beds. And so we did a cost analysis, and it turns out the average cost of leaving a person on the street was about $40,000 a year. Mm-hmm. The cost of housing them was $13,000 a year.
Wow.
So you free up jails, you free up ER, you free up hospitals, which are not what people needed. Mm-hmm. And so for $40,000 a year, the community and the person were getting no foreseeable benefits. But for $13,000 a year, you were changing somebody's life, and it was life or death. They would no longer die on the streets.
Yeah.
So there's a great economic argument as well as a moral argument to housing first.
Sure. I'm Tony Rossi. You're listening to Christopher Close Up, and I've been talking to Kathy Izzard about her memoir, The 100-Story Home. She is doing great work with her project called Homeless to Homes. Like she just said, it's got an economic benefit. So in our society that often looks at the bottom line, this is a great approach. And this is really an excellent book to read, because as Kathy said, it deals with her mom's mental illness and the challenge of dealing with that and the hope that can come for people who are struggling with it. And also for the hope to people that they can get involved and make a difference. Kathy was an ordinary person who is now helping to house homeless people, getting them off the streets and likely saving lives. It's a sign that a little initiative, as the Christophers say, can really move us forward, that each of us is Christopher's Christ bearers, which is what the word means, in our own way, if we just see a need and try to fill it. And that's exactly what Kathy did. So, Kathy, thanks for sharing your story today and in the book, The 100-Story Home.
Thank you.
Now, before we end today's show, here's a message the Christophers would like to share with you.
The grace of God has a way of sneaking up on us. And if we're not paying attention, it might even slip right past us. That's why the Christophers have prepared a news note called Opening Yourself to God's Grace. It will help you become more aware of the moments in your life when God makes his presence known in unexpected ways. Moments that can draw beauty out of brokenness and allow you to experience the depths of his love. To request your free copy of Opening Yourself to God's Grace, send an email to radio@christophers.org or call our toll-free number at 1-888-298-4050. That's 1-888-298-4050. We look forward to hearing from you.
In closing, I want to thank all our listeners for tuning in today, and I encourage you to visit our website at christophers.org to learn more about the Christophers and to download free literature and podcasts. When you're there, you can also find links to our blog and our Facebook and Twitter pages. And if you have any questions or comments about the show, you can send an email to radio@christophers.org. Our engineer for today's show is Brian Bonifacio, and I'm Tony Rossi, your host. Thanks again for joining us, and remember that it's better to light one candle than to curse the darkness.